Ahoy, hoy, Patreonarinos. Welcome to the third episode of Talk to the Audience. That's its official title. I am Bob Mackey, of course. You know me. You give me money every month, of course. And who else is here, as always?
Henry Gilbert.
That's
Mimi
right.
Pond's biggest family.
Really?
As of
the publication of a certain article. So yes, we're back again. This is a monthly series in which we respond to your comments. We talk about Simpsons news, I guess. I think this is a good vehicle for that. Things have been happening. There's things to talk about. So this will be more than just your comments this time. So where should we get started with all of this? There's a few things we want to start with before we get to the comments.
There were a lot of like news-ish, well, not even news-type things, but it just... Well, I think I really want to start with the fall of the Simpsons video because that was getting shared around a lot.
That's right, and people were demanding our opinions on it.
They were, and it kind of was connected to, I don't think it was the same person, but the person who had like the, no, there was that separate graph that somebody else did of, these are my personal reviews of every episode in every season.
Right.
And charting like, oh, this season gets worse and worse and worse. And it was, it was all about the downfall of the Simpsons, and then this person on YouTube makes a video on the fall of the Simpsons.
Right, and his name is Super Eyepatch Wolf. He's actually a really great YouTuber. He does a lot of really informative videos. A lot of his anime videos are really good, just like talking about like what are the best manga in Shonen Jump, or what's the most popular manga in Shonen Jump? What are they about? Are they any good? Like things about why the animation in the new Berserk anime is so bad, and like why One Piece is great, like why things are great. Like, but this was one of the videos I've seen from him that I was just like, I don't care for this very much.
Well, yeah.
But I'm not that angry about it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm not that angry either. But it did make me think about people on Twitter joke about the discourse when it comes to politics. But that is also how I feel like this is the Simpsons discourse, in that the things the fall of the Simpsons really hit, and not to say these weren't original ideas by the video creator, but that it was like a lot of stuff I've heard a million times. I read this entire book, Zombie Simpsons, about 8 years ago, which was interesting at the time. But the more I've dug into Simpsons history again, just through this, I kind of reject that way of thinking. And it's also the similar theme that Fall of the Simpsons is going for.
Yeah, I mean, he's borrowing a lot of popular theories, critical theories about the Simpsons and why it's not as good anymore. And I was saying a lot of these things just a few years ago. I'm not trying to say that we are smarter just because we have a Simpsons podcast, but I think the way we've been viewing the Simpsons at very like on a very granular, deep level for doing this podcast, I think it has changed my mind on a whole lot of things I assume were true before. And seeing these ideas trotted out again, they do seem valid at a certain level, but once you are approaching them on a podcasting level, they don't hold up as much as you think they do. Again, we are just people. We're just regular people, but the way we're approaching The Simpsons now has really informed my my opinions about it and changed my opinions about it.
Yeah, when you've put, I would say, if you combine the recordings and the hours of research we put into it, like, just from the start of this podcast, we have put over 400 hours of research into The Simpsons again, on top of our decades of fandom anyway. That, yeah, it made me see that the complaints that I saw in the fall of The Simpsons was kind of these macro-level complaints.
Right.
That makes sense when you think you know the show, and I'm not even saying I think I know the show. Like, we actually, in our first Bill Oakley interview, there were multiple times where we're like, well, and then this happened, right? And he says, you have that wrong. Like, that there are a number of myths about the show and who makes the show. And that was, like, one of the first things that bothered me in the fall of The Simpsons video was that It is absolutely true that Matt Groening, Sam Simon, and James L. Brooks had major impact on the show in its creation, but you really have to talk about how it turned from the show was in season 1 and 2, and then like 3, and then 4. It's a constant transition. What you think is a great season 6 episode is very different from what is a great season 3 episode.
Right. I do feel like, so in this video, he puts it around season 8 where The Simpsons got bad. The Simpsons that's ideal for him seems like a late season 2, early season 3 Simpsons, where...
which is not my ideal Simpsons.
I mean, those are great, and we love watching them and podcasting about them, but that more grounded element, the more James L. Brooksy element, was kind of gone by season 4. And his metric of judging the quality of the shows outside of his personal preferences is IMDb.
Yes.
Which is not a good metric to judge any kind of entertainment, because it's like Boondock Saints is the number one movie, apparently. It's just like it's like self-selecting nerds voting for things.
Now, if I was making a video essay, it is attractive to use something like that, because otherwise you're just like, this is only my opinion, and taking metadata like that from IMDb will give you more like, well, these are stats. This isn't just my opinion I'm saying to you. These right. are statistics I can show you, but it's really just a bunch of other opinions brought together. And it's also like, well, to truly do it, I mean, you'd have to really watch every episode again with a critical eye. And that is hundreds of hours. Like, nobody, it's a major task to do. But
we'll have to wait for the Paste article about that, that I want to write, but I demand $10,000
yeah,
up front.
I mean, that's a book, really.
Yeah,
like,
it really
ranking
is.
Every Simpsons episode from the beginning. But so then he kind of transitions to into like, he talks about the writers, but not really about the writers, when he says, well, these people left. And the big one that got me was like, I believe he showed that Oakley and Weinstein left earlier than they did or later than they did. It's like, no, they were there for season 8. You
well,
can't.
I mean, at a macro level, that argument, I don't like it, because so his idea is like season 8 is where things got bad. And then from season 8 to season 9, transferring from the Oakley and Weinstein era to the Mike Scully era and after, a lot of the key people associated with the show left, and that is why he thinks it's bad. But as we learn from Talking Simpsons between season 4 and season 5, like 90% of the staff left.
Yeah.
And the show, I think, only got better. So just
because a
turnover
doesn't mean it definitely gets worse. Yeah. But I mean, a change in creative, if you don't replace them with other creatives, that is a problem.
Right.
And I guess also too, the my biggest issue was that one, well, I had two major issues. One, that he blamed the exit of James L. Brooks. It was like, well, James L. Brooks was pretty much done with 4. Like,
yeah.
He'd moved on to The Critic. He'd maybe be there for like, Merkin would still, he's told the story on commentaries of when they had the big pitch meeting for all the episodes of the seasons, Brooks would be there. He would be approving it, but he would not be there even for like rewrites or recordings, or even to get them to do what he would do of, I'm going to get this famous person I know who said no to you. He wasn't really doing that.
Yeah.
And and so then that he used Principal and the Pauper as the watershed moment. I was like, that is total Simpsons discourse. That was a major, major part of Zombie Simpsons. They're like, this is when it all went wrong.
That's a pet peeve of mine. I will say, you can say the death of Maude Flanders. I will let you say the death of Maude Flanders is a turning point, but we're going to get to it. We're going to talk about it in a few years. Principal and the Pauper is a funny episode, and I don't think it destroys the show. And I think it actually helps explain who Skinner is, even though it has to throw away a lot of his history. Up to that point, The Simpsons did not care about continuity.
And it was very eye-opening listening to the commentary that Ken Keeler, you could say this is Monday morning quarterbacking by Ken Keeler on a hated episode, but I do believe him on the commentary when he says that it was about making fans angry and
right.
saying, we changed a popular thing on this show and every person in Springfield rejects it. And so it's about how fans reject changes to a sitcom.
Right.
Though I will say that is kind of, they'd already tread that territory with Poochie just a few episodes earlier.
It is true. It was
and
like
same
a different
with Grimes too, and Grimey.
I feel like it's it's a different way of exploring a show's relationship with its fans.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's a valid way to do it. But I want to get to it. We won't go too far into that episode because we're going to talk a lot about it in a few years. But one of the other things that Super Eye Patch Wolf said, another pet peeve of mine, is the like, suddenly jerk-ass Homer came along and ruined the entire show. And as we've seen, Homer is pretty much jerk-ass Homer selectively from season 4 on. Like, his character is not, I mean, there are some basic core elements to Homer, but his character will change based on the needs of the story, as do a lot of the characters. He's not that consistent. And we just recorded Lisa on Ice, and it's like, that is the jerkiest of jerk-ass Homers that would even go beyond things you'd see in season 12 and season 11.
I've never seen a crueler Homer than that. Even the Homer who taunts T-shirts to be shot at him that will end up killing Maude, and he also causes Maude's death by double parking in the ambulance zone so there was no chance of resuscitating her. That is horribly cruel, but I would say Homer saying, to think of all the time I wasted on you.
And threatening to either kill or torture a pet, and also like straight up like almost taking
you.
A swing at Bart and Bart flinching. Yeah, I mean, he was that. All those elements were played up in order to communicate the idea of the story, like these sports parents are bad, and like why are these kids' sports even exist? Is it for the sake of the parents?
Yeah. And The video brings up the Gaga episode as these other like very celebrity driven episodes, which is absolutely a crutch. They go on way too much now.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
I agree. But when Aerosmith arrived on the show, Krusty gets canceled. The classic baseball episode, those are absolutely starfucker episodes.
Yeah, they showing up to like say a line and then, oh my God, it's so-and-so. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I'm driving Mel Brooks. Wow. Yeah,
that's a really extreme example, but I'll take it too.
Yeah. And but so it shows you these things were there. They weren't as obvious. And I also think too, it is about growing up and your recognition of the show. Obviously, I think my childhood is the right one, but
we grew up in the correct decade.
But as I aged up with the show, I came to recognize things more, and it actually was at a better time for it because by season 7 and 8, I was 15 and 16, and I think I was at a good age to recognize the more meta commentary that the 7 and 8 were really getting into. And then as I got older and older and then saw like the kind of step back from the meta commentary and the show was more about saying, eh, fuck it. That's when I was like, no, I want smart things for me. Yeah. Who watched every episode.
Yeah, I do feel like there are some valid reasons that he does not. I mean, valid to me. This is all just like our own arguments. But where I see The Simpsons failing as the 2000s rolled on is I feel like These are not surprising things. Like Al Jean has been there too long. Mm. Al Jean is like a hilarious comedy writer, but he's also getting very old. The Simpsons has always benefited from fresh blood, as we saw between seasons 4 and 5. I also feel like it's a show that's getting increasingly more expensive as time goes on, even though it makes Fox a lot of money. So because of that, animation has to be streamlined, and they can't trust viewers as much with esoteric jokes or references. Like, what made me mad about The Simpsons watching it throughout the 2000s is just like, oh, they read that sign joke. They over-explained that joke. That joke went on way too long. Like, they didn't trust the audience to be okay with them just moving on. I think in Itchy and Scratchy Land, I pointed out, Marge is like, oh, see what's going on in that robot's head? That's why your robot never worked. The joke, that was a joke, and they moved on to the next scene. Modern Simpsons would probably do like a 30-second cutaway of Homer like injuring himself building a robot or something like that. Like, they are not as confident as they should be, which is why I didn't like the movie as much as I wanted to.
Yeah, that is disappointing, and it's another thing about, like, it's not that a ton of effort necessarily translates to better show, but you get the feeling like Al Jean's getting old. They're all older guys with like kids or even grandkids probably at this point. In the case of like Max Prost and Tom Gamble.
Yes.
Well, they just sound very old.
Tom Gamble.
But what I mean is like they want to go home early. They don't want to stay in the office all night thinking of Colonel Hap Happablap, you know, that are ridiculous names like that. But
yeah.
I was glad you mentioned animation because that was my tweet, one of my most popular tweets in a while, which was very popular with people who work in the animation industry, believe it or not. But it was that that video's view on The Simpsons and the decline of it has the problem that most Simpsons fans have, which I also have too. It is very writer focused, which I get it. The writers are the main people talking on the commentaries, are the main people you interview too. It's who we've interviewed. And it is undeniably a writer driven show. But those first 8 seasons, like the animation made a huge difference. The animator, the director, is the joke teller of the show. And so I contend that a great animation can save a crummy joke.
Yes.
But a great joke will be hurt by bad animation or lackluster animation. And I don't want to blame the people making it now, the animators now, because like you said, I bet they have way less of a budget, but way less like freedom to do what they want to do.
Yeah, and in fact, somebody reached out to me because I don't like to be too mean about the people working on the show because I know they're in a system that has streamlined a lot of things but has made a lot of things worse, and they were talking about the animation where it's like more than ever Korea is super on model. Of course Korea does all of the grunt work of animation. Mm-hmm. So if they would see a funny expression that we would point out on an episode, like, oh, that's a great expression I haven't seen before, like look at that move we've seen Homer do. Mm-hmm. They would make it as like on model as possible because they have to pay for the retakes, and if they see a weird face, they might see that as a mistake that they'll have to pay for later. So that's why The Simpsons looks kind of lifeless now. I mean, there are nice touches, there are cool couch gags, but I feel like that has hurt it as well. Like, you don't see the animators' distinct styles coming out. You don't see strange-looking characters, but they're still entertaining in their own way. Like,
I feel like guys only like David Silverman get to animate the creative stuff now. Like, he gets the permission to say, like, no, draw it this way. Don't go off model. I give you permission. But I think there's other lifers there who, well, there's fewer lifers there too. And I think it's a big change that, like, they lost Rich Moore, they lost Wes Archer, they lost Susie Dieter. For a time, they lost David Silverman to Pixar, they lost Brad Bird, they lost Jim Reardon. Like, these were major creative forces, and Jeffrey Lynch too, Carlos Baeza, all these very important directors and their teams underneath them who weren't replaced by people who, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, like, even if they're not as creatively gifted as those people, maybe they weren't given the same amount of ability, of leeway either to be creative.
Right. I think the system that has been built is now just pushes a lot of ideas out, pushes a lot of artistic qualities out.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right, Henry. Like, in his argument, and I like this guy and I like his videos, but in his argument, he's like, these key people left the show. Like, the visual architects of The Simpsons are all gone except for David Silverman. The people who designed the look of the show and the characters and the world have all left. And the people who replace them, I'm sure they're working hard, but those, they are, if James L. Brooks is important to you, then let me think, Jim Reardon should be important to you too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think Mark Kirkland is still there. So one of the kind of, I mean, he was the second string of new directors, but he still counts, I think.
Yeah. Well, and by new, you mean new in season two.
Yes, like 1990.
Three. Yes. Yeah.
That's what I mean by new. So yeah, I recommend you go watch the video and watch his other videos and maybe let us know what you think of his argument. Sorry, Henry, go ahead.
I was happy to give more of a insight into it, though I want us to get, I feel like we could make this video, but once we get past season 12, I feel like we kind of have to wait till then
to
really see it.
Once the move to digital happens, but I feel like the digital tool set that was used probably like around season 20 and onwards has only made things significantly worse. It's hard to watch. It's hard to watch, especially after watching rewatching the show so much for doing these podcasts. So,
well, and knowing how digital animation does not necessarily mean stiff. Like, I feel Rick and Morty shows you can do quite a lot with digital animation.
Yeah, and like Steven Universe is digital. OKKO is digital.
Everything is digital.
Nothing
now
is not digital. It just depends on the tool set you're using and how much you're willing to work with that to make a non-digital looking show, I think. So yeah, that was our thoughts on the Super Eye Patch Wolf video. Check it out. Let us know what you think. And we also have one more thing to go into before we go into the comments. And that was something Mimi Pond, she wrote, which episode?
Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire.
Yes.
The first aired episode of The Simpsons.
That's right. And she gave some thoughts on what it was like to not be picked as a staff writer, which was kind of disappointing. I don't know if Henry, do you want to read this?
Yeah, I'll read the quote just so we're not, I don't want to paraphrase her. But so yeah, Mimi Pond was doing an interview for a new comic book she was doing about her life and loves and her career, and she was asked about how she wrote the first episode of The Simpsons but yet wasn't a staff writer, unlike most people who did write episodes. And so this was her response. I was never invited to be on staff, and I never knew why for the longest time. No one ever called me or explained to me or apologized or anything. And it wasn't until years later that I found out that Sam Simon, who was the showrunner, didn't want any women around because he was going through a divorce. It remained a boys' club for a good long time. I feel like I was just as qualified as anyone else who came along and got hired on the show. And it was just because I was a woman that I was, you know, not allowed entry into that club. I always wind up being the turd in the punch bowl because the show is so beloved and everything, and I'm sorry to burst bubbles, but, laughs, it wasn't a pleasant experience for me.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I feel like even today, 20 plus years later, the role of the comedy writer is still viewed as a very gendered thing. Like, it's a male role. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm saying that's what people think. And I think, like, Mike Lazo from Adult Swim, I forget the quote, I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, well, women in the writer's room ruin everything, or they make things less funny. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but the idea is, like, no, the guys will come up with the funny jokes, and the women will just, like, tisk-tisk at them or whatever.
That I believe, is the fear of some older men in the world of comedy,
right?
R.I.P. Jerry Lewis, but that wasn't.
Oh, we killed him, right?
We did.
But Retronauts made a Secret of Mana remake happen, so
it goes both ways.
Circle of life.
No, this goes into a big other topic of, are women funny or not? Which I am of the stance they are.
Yes,
they
yes.
can be just as funny as men. And
I think right now Lauren Lapkus is the funniest living human being.
She is so funny.
I can't think
funny.
Of a funnier person than Lauren Lapkus.
God, I love her so much. All of the Wild Horses are great. They're
oh, yeah,
so great.
Yeah.
I love Mary Houlihan. Mary Holland, who's also on works with Lauren Lapkus.
Yeah,
so great
all too, the but, Wild Horses. They're an improv group, yeah. by the way. Go see them if you're in California.
Though, see, this is exactly, Tina Fey made this point on 30 Rock. Like, no, I'm not going to just list women for you. Okay, women are funny. But so it's it, but the bigger thing here is also about opportunity that Mimi Pond, as Bill Oakley said to us in our first interview with him about all the people leaving from season four, it was a golden ticket to prosperity and making whatever movie, a show, whatever you wanted to make, probably.
Yeah.
Being a Simpsons staff writer, being a producer on the show, and that she wasn't invited to that club, nor was any other woman, then leads to a domino effect of, these women weren't given that opportunity. They weren't given later opportunities. They didn't get to run their own show because they didn't get the opportunity after that one. And it's especially disappointing to find out through Pond that the late Sam Simon is the culprit in
yeah,
this.
Yeah, for being such a great guy who gave to so many great causes, he was not that great about women.
No, I mean, that thing, like, it's also, you know, it is unfortunate that he has passed away and he can't say his side of the story
right,
on this.
Right.
It's but it is, I mean, the numbers don't lie. They didn't have a woman writer on staff until the sixth season.
Yeah, and we actually talked to Bill Oakley about that in an upcoming interview. Not to spoil anything, but not to put words in his mouth, but I'm pretty sure he was inferring that Jennifer Crittenden, who wrote some of my favorite episodes of that era, the PTA disbands, Scenes from the Class Struggle in Springfield, she didn't probably not have the best time there in a room full of guys who all knew each other went to school with each other.
And he legitimately called, like, he used the term boys club.
Yeah,
We didn't even ask him to use that term. It's like, and so it's just unfortunate, especially when, like, there were women who wrote on the show. Like, you know, I would love to interview Jennifer Crittenden about this, or Mimi Pond, or Nell Scovell as well, who wrote the the Blowfish episode.
Right.
But especially interesting to me is Nell Scovell, because when Gene and Reese, they got to hire a staff for The Critic, they did hire her. Like, they felt she was ready for it, but apparently she wasn't for The Simpsons. And if it really was just like that Sam Simon said, he can't work around women because he's going through a divorce, so no woman will be hired on The Simpsons staff.
No dames. Yeah.
That's just gross. That is,
it is gross
to me. And
but not probably not uncommon in writers' rooms at that
absolutely
time.
Absolutely not.
And this is not like a class on institutional sexism, but this is like example number 9 million of how just being a white guy is a qualification to get you in the door.
Yes.
And that's basically all you need to just have access to things.
There is no such thing as a meritocracy, folks.
Yes.
But it's, though also this is like, this is two white guys talking about,
let me tell you about my perspective.
Sexism. Yeah. So I would also love to hear what, you know, the women out there listening to this, what they and other women Simpsons fans think of this revelation and knowing that women were so unwelcome, at least in the early years. And this is not to say, like, Jennifer Crittenden was the first. There weren't a ton after. There's Carolyn Amine. There's
Rachel Polito.
Yeah. And
it was a few years
others.
After Crittenden left, I think.
Yes, yeah. And it's just like, it is suspicious. And the only reason I wouldn't want to interview Jennifer Crittenden about this is, the like, her career is bigger than being the first woman of The Simpsons.
Yeah, Seinfeld, Arrested Development, like Veep, so many. I mean, I think she might be too big for us. I hope not.
I definitely think so. But that she might, like, why would she want to just think about, like, the time she had a bad time at The Simpsons?
Right, right.
You know? And two, Mimi Pond, she mentions it more in the interview, but that she kind of has the freedom to say these things because she says she's done with Hollywood. She's making her comic book. She's making what she wants to make. And meanwhile, like, there are other women who can't say these things because then some guy who's a friend with Sam, who was friends with Sam Simon, perhaps, would say, hey, fuck you. I'm not hiring
like
you.
Like a gray list or blacklist or whatever.
Exactly. And so, yeah, it as a left-leaning Simpsons fan who, you know, is for equality of women and is trying to be better with the sexism that is just all around you in America, this was a very big downer. It doesn't mean you can't like the show. It doesn't mean you have to burn all your Simpsons DVDs or take away your fun memories, but it's just something like, you do have to consider with the history of the show. It's like, it is part of it.
And I mean, who knows, maybe season 6 and 7 are my favorites because there was a women's perspective weighing in on the jokes and the stories and things like that. Maybe that's why I like those seasons so much and I don't know it.
Just having a woman in the room can change that. That going back to the Fall of the Simpsons video, even an executive producer, like a showrunner is obviously the last, they are the author of the show, the auteur of a show, if anyone is in their seasons. But the makeup of a room, it is like a chemical compound of just like, well, that writer was there to punch up that writer's joke, and then that writer said that, and just having a woman in the rewrite room could change the makeup of it as well. They might say, oh yeah, why would I say that joke? Same with having, if they had a black man in the room, if they had a gay person in the room, if they had all these people, which again, Simpsons not a very diverse staff.
No, mostly white guys.
It is true.
But I think most of TV is like that.
Yeah, it's not, the Simpsons were hardly alone in that. And I remember they treated it as a very big deal a few years ago when, I believe it was the second season of Community, Dan Harmon had half the writing staff was women. And he said he went to real effort for that. And that is the baseline equality. You know, like, obviously, yes, you hire the best person for a job. Duh. But he saw it as important to have that mix of experiences in there as well as everybody being funny. But that it was a landmark thing to even have half the room be women. It's even weirder. Like, would you ever hear of a comedy show in America having more women on the writing staff than men?
Only if it was a show about a woman or about feminism or something like that.
I believe the Cameron Esposito, Rhea Butcher show, Take My Wife.
Yeah, something like that.
They had, I believe, an all-women writing staff, and I think Orange is the New Black is predominantly women, but those are also shows that are about women, and you definitely would want to focus women writing staff. I feel like it's getting better from an outsider perspective who does not work in Hollywood and just sees the names of people who write on things. It's just my observation here. But yeah, anyway, I especially feel bad for Mimi Pond that she could have like created like 5 TV shows at this point. If she had been a season 1 staff writer on The Simpsons and all the doors that would have opened.
That is your golden ticket for Hollywood fame and fortune.
Who there didn't get like a development deal who was a season 1 producer on The Simpsons?
Even people who did are probably just living comfortably. Like they did all their pilots, they made all their money, and now they're just, you know, hanging out, writing a thing or two. Like, I don't know what happened to, let me think, Jeff Martin. He's probably doing okay.
Oh yeah, he seems pretty, I mean,
he's not begging for change anywhere.
No, he probably can just be like, oh, you want to write, you want a punch up on this movie script? $10 million. I'll show up for a day and give me $50,000.
Yeah, that's what John Vitti does. I mean, exactly. They're all well-known guys. So yeah, that was our bit of 30 minutes of negativity.
Sorry.
It's okay. These are all things to talk about. Yeah, we recommend you go watch the Super Eye Patch Wolf video. Maybe we'll link to the Mimi Pond article. It's not just about Mimi Pond. It's a bunch of different women's perspectives, right?
Well, this was sourced from an overall interview with Mimi Pond about her new book.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I'll put a link to that in the Patreon post for this. But now let's get into some comments, and we're going to go over to the Laser Time comments. So it's possible the people that who wrote these comments don't know we're saying them, but you know what? They put them in a public spot. So let's start with Lisa's rival. And this is Shy Fonzie. Now, Henry, is Shy Fonzie like a Talk Radar character or something?
It is a classic Talk Radar character. Back when we had the energy to do impersonations all the time, Michael did Fonzie once, but it was more quiet. And people were like, is this Fonzie shy? And then he started doing less. He got more and more shy.
That's great. I never listened to Talk Radar because I didn't know about it. I probably would have loved it.
Well, you got 800 hours of it if you ever want to jump into it.
I'm sure
600 hours.
The audio quality is great.
Yeah, I mean, it's for its time.
I'm ashamed of all of my audio quality for episodes 5 years and heading back. So let's go on. So Shy Fonzie says, this episode hits close to home for me, Lisa's rival. I remember seeing it right before I went into the academically talented magnet school program in a lower income neighborhood in fifth grade. It made me terrified that when I switched in, I would be a relative idiot. All the kids had to take band because classical music makes you smarter, obviously. And I chose saxophone because I wanted to be like Lisa.
Aww.
I kind of want to do that too. Yeah. Many other kids in the program had the type of family that had put them into piano or violin when they were 5, and I had no musical ability. So like many other gifted kids do when faced with something that they are not naturally gifted at, I became extremely resentful of band, and I never took it again. Mm. I mean, we talked about being failed child geniuses many times on this. But yeah, I always think of the Lisa quote from the last episode of season 8. Bart says, I thought you wanted a challenge. Duh, a challenge I could do. I think of that all the time because, yeah, I tried picking up guitar for a few years and it wasn't something I was immediately good at. So I was like, fuck guitar. Who cares?
Yeah, I think Homer's the lesson is never try.
Yeah.
If you're not instantly good at something, it's not worth doing. That kind of got to me, but and was exacerbated by being a gifted kid, which is just your teachers telling you, no, you're smarter than everybody else. So why try
hard? Yes, exactly.
Mark says, I heard the gay straight earring rules in middle school too, but my classmates were so mean, even if you got it pierced on the straight side, others would say, yeah, but you're this close to being gay, spreading their hands to indicate the distance between the person's ears. Kids can be so cruel. We can? Thanks, Mom.
You know, I think I've said it before, maybe not on air, but Chris Antista tells some of the dirtiest jokes I've ever heard on air. Yet he didn't realize until we pointed it out that that was a joke about the phrase butt pirate.
That was so surprising.
That shocked me. I was like, Chris.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Yeah. As we know about kids, like, anything makes you gay, at least in our experience growing up as kids in the 90s. Everything made you gay.
Video games and anime especially made me the gayest boy you'd ever see.
If you stepped slightly outside of the line of what was defendable straightness,
your gender role,
you're a fucking gay boy.
Yes. Are you a child? Does that still happen? I hope it doesn't.
Yeah, but I hope not.
God. So let's move on. Purple Comet says, Lisa's plot was instantly relatable to me as someone who was the, quote, smart one, unquote, until I reached sixth grade and someone even smarter, more studious, joined my school. Still, it's weird how Skinner and Miss Hoover gloss right over Lisa's obvious sabotage of Allison, even given how bored they were by the whole thing. Yeah, they were over diorama-rama. But
that was similar to Chalmers going, yeah, he seems to know all the kids' names.
Yeah.
Just like, that was a thing in multiple Merkin episodes, which was funny, but of just giving up on like, look, we got to move. This next plot point has to happen.
It is
I don't care.
Really hanging a lantern on. It's like, we just need to end the show. We need a resolution. And it's funny that they don't care too. So it's not too lazy.
Well, and speaking of laziness.
Oh boy. Let me tell you, the comments on this for Laser Time were almost all about boys to men and something Chris said.
Yes,
I'm not even sure as a joke, or maybe he actually thought it, but yeah.
There were definitely also, we'll get to it in the Patreon comments, but definitely some discussion of whether this was the worst episode or not. Batman Boy 11 says, I don't know if I'd label this episode the worst, but it is all caps pretty bad. The shoddily put together old animation that varies in quality wildly is so distracting. The clips leave out so much context and a lot of the best jokes, and the episodes in general just make no real sense. I get the context for why the episode is like this, and I don't blame the people behind it, but I never rewatch this one for obvious reasons.
I agree. I will probably never watch it again unless we somehow are crazy and start revisiting episodes.
When we're 50.
That desperate, yeah.
When we're 50 and we've done every episode, we're like, well, time to start back over and see what, as a 52-year-old, I think of these episodes.
God, I hope it doesn't come to that. There's too many cartoons to talk about. So up next, Laser Time comments on Itchy and Scratchy Land. Big C says, great episode as always, guys. Thank you. By the way, you guys mentioned Jerry Lewis at the end of the episode discussing Euro Disney, so the Talking Simpsons curse continues. Although the episode did release a week early on Patreon before he died, so it should it still count? R.I.P. Jerry Lewis. Yeah, we've killed again, Henry. I don't know what to say. Gordie Howe was... James Brown died 10 years before that episode. Never mind.
No, but definitely Gordie Howe was a big one. And I think we've...
There's one more.
Well, we kept hoping it would be Henry Kissinger, but it wasn't. I forget who else. The Gordie Howe is just the big one where I had to
re-record it. You even recorded it like a disclaimer.
Well, because if I was a listener, I knew if I was a listener to the podcast and heard people talking about Gordie Howe and then like, why are you talking about him like he isn't dead?
Right.
You definitely, well, on the Sideshow Bob Roberts episode, there were a number of comments that agreed with like a tweet I said of, you are lucky we recorded this before the Charleston stuff, because like we would have had even more shit to say.
Yeah, I mean, we typically record things 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time. So whenever there's a really old guest or a guest that has aged to like impossibly old, I am always worried. Like, I just hang in there for 2 weeks, please.
Opus Anders says, Chris will like this. When I was a kid, the closest theme park was King's Dominion in Richmond. Before it became Paramount's King's Dominion, it was almost exclusively themed in Hanna-Barbera's shows and characters. They did have themed parking areas like the Yogi Bear lot or the Snagglepuss lot. It's been years since I've been there, so I don't know if they're still those.
I wonder
still
if they use those. Is the Snagglepuss lot where you go to the bathroom?
Drawn by Hig Heisler.
Yeah, he's somebody. He's made up, by the way. So DJC1017 says, my name is Dominic with a K. So the Bort joke always makes me laugh because I have one of those names you can spell in different ways. The only time I ever came close to finding something with my name on it was when I was a kid on a field trip to Six Flags and I was browsing the Daffy Duck license plates and hoping by some miracle they had my name. As I was looking, I saw the first three letters of my name and got excited, only to realize it's spelled the other way, Dominic with no K. That day I felt defeated, and the Jakes, James, and Johns of the world have won. Yes.
Yeah, but there were a number of great comments and like tweets at me about it and everything saying like, my name was this, my name was this. And definitely, you know, like we said, there were people, there were already like white guy names that aren't in there. And then yeah. On top of that, people, the non-white people had even more trouble. Like, yeah, I will never see my Spanish name in here.
I mean, I think that they, if this sort of thing still happens, they either like 3D print something or airbrush something. I don't think, mm-hmm. I mean, I know if you go to a place, they'll have keychains with names on them, but I feel like you can't rely on those biblical and like, you know, like pilgrim names like John and James. And
well, even in the 90s, America was becoming even more of a melting pot that you really...
I mean, white people have way different names now than they used to. I don't see those reliable, you know, old-timey names anymore. I feel That's true. I'm one of the last Bobs to exist.
Yeah, you really don't hear Bob as much anymore. Well, like, and every friend I had as a kid was Chris, and their name was Chris. And meanwhile, I blame, you know, the celebrities who name their kids Apple and River, right. And then people are like, oh, I could just name them whatever. And then Titus said, love this episode. Interesting tidbit about Parents Island, which, yes, everybody told me about this. I'm sorry I missed it.
I want to point something out as a note of kindness. If you see someone point something out, you don't need to point it out again, because I know we get at least one thing wrong in every episode. Mm. If we see one comment about it, that's enough. I just hate seeing eight comments about it. Like, you got this wrong. I get it.
Now, I don't blame people who, if you're tweeting at me, you don't know everybody else who's tweeted at me. I get it. And
I appreciate
you're just
the
trying
effort.
To help.
Yeah.
I definitely appreciate it. And I think it shows like we put all this effort into research, but we can't get everything right.
That's why I'm so in my own head doing research. Like, no, yes. I have to find out who this person is and what they did and when they died. So.
But anyway, so continuing what Titus said, interesting tidbit that the Parents Island Itchy and Scratchy Land is a reference to Paradise Island in Disney World that had dance clubs for adults and teens. The quote was, it's always New Year's Eve. Paradise Island was a Michael Eisner creation and only lasted until a new CEO stepped in. Hmm. So there we go.
Yes. Well, I mean, I made the connection, but I didn't say on the show. It's just like, oh, Parents Island must be Pleasure Island, like in Pinocchio. But I didn't think it was actually ever a real thing. And that seems kind of weird. Kind of a sleazy...
I think they realized it got too sleazy. Though, obviously, there are places you can get drunk AF.
That's true.
In Disneyland.
But I feel like you're less likely to get felt up outside of Pleasure Island. So now we're heading into the Patreon comments. Let's go to Sideshow Bob Roberts. And Volpe says, this is one of the best episodes of an amazing season. You guys definitely did it justice. Thank you. Henry promised fire, and this almost delivered. What? Within 6 months, you'll be ending the show singing the Internationale, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Nixon Land and pretty much everything Rick Perlstein writes is worth reading. He does a great job situating Nixon into the political landscape of the post-68 era. It's not really a Watergate book, though, as it only discusses his first term. The sequel, Invisible Bridge, covers Watergate and the rise of Reagan. It's particularly interesting for those unfamiliar with how Reagan worked with fringe hucksters like Jerry Falwell, Oral Roberts, and Billy Graham to create the modern cultural wedge as we know it today. And that is true. I feel like a lot of people don't know that the modern ultra-religious right is a fairly new, and by fairly new, I mean 30 years old, phenomenon. It's not like something that has been part of America from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And also Iron Joe 99 on that episode again called us murderers for killing off Jerry Lewis. But then I got a frequent question I wanted to answer about the critic, generally our critic episode. So after about four, well, I'll just read the question, then I'll explain it. Zachary Adams says, What's the name of the interstitial music that when you go to break? I know it, but I can never remember. Also, Stubby K will always be Marvin Acme to me, which we did not mention.
That's true. Actually, for whatever reason, I was looking up pictures of Stubby K after the episode was recorded. I'm like, oh my God, he was in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Yes. That's where I know him from.
It was great they cast him in that. It was a perfect role for a Stubby K to play.
Yes, he is a 5x5 lover.
But yeah, Zachary, this is just a little behind-the-scenes stuff, which is what this show is for. When I was first editing the Critic episodes, I was giving it the same break music as The Simpsons, which is music from the arcade game. But after a few episodes, like, this really doesn't fit the jazzy tone of the show. And I was trying to find, like, interstitial music for the Critic, but in my research, I could only find the opening and ending, not any of the in-between music on it. So I was like, okay, we have chiptune music on The Simpsons. We should have chiptune music here. So I looked up a classic jazz standard for chiptunes, which is, it is an 8-bit cover of Take 5, a song by Dave Brubeck. That's the original. And the creator of this re-instrumentation of it is Industrial Shadow X on YouTube. So if you want to look it up.
He does good work. I like his old stuff. You know what? It's a shame that Konami never made a 4-player Critic arcade brawler. I'm just seeing in my head. I think it'll be Jay Sherman, of course, Duke Phillips, Jeremy, and I'm trying to think of what a fourth character
would
be.
Think Doris.
Doris. Oh, wow.
They have the one girl character to be the Marge of it. And, well, who would be kidnapped? Would Marty be kidnapped?
Maybe.
No, Margo would be kidnapped.
Margo. Yeah. Margo and Marty. Mm-hmm. And maybe Zoltan. Zoltan? Zoltar?
Oh, yeah, Zoltan.
Hello.
All right, so are we going on to Solomon Mars says, oh, Tom Pollock says, speaking of Pulitzers in 1998, my next door neighbor would actually win a Pulitzer for feature writing.
Wow.
Everyone thought it was really cool to have someone in our community win a major award. For a few weeks, everyone in our community went out of their way to offer congratulations. I think they just wanted to see the award and probably be nice. Sure.
I mean, was he disco dancing around wearing the award too, just like Jay did?
Yeah, I mean, you gotta get a chain then and put that thing around your neck.
So Solomon Mars said also about this episode of The Critic. Okay, I may be one of only a few people who knew what the Rosebud Frozen Peas was referencing at the time, and only because my stepdad is a huge blurred. Huh. That means black nerd. I'm a year older than Miss Wiki Perez and have been going to Dragon Con here in Atlanta since 1993. At the show, they would sell VHS tapes of things you couldn't see on TV, outtakes, banned stuff, unaired pilots, and unfinished versions of movies that hadn't come out yet. I remember getting a weird FX-less version of Jurassic Park, some Jackie Chan movies, an extended cut of Close Encounters, which my mom still owns and watches, where they show the inside of the mothership, which is cool. The extended cut of Aliens, where they show Newt's family and the entire station bustling with people, and a VHS of random Hollywood underground cinema stuff like that Orson Welles commercial. That's why I loved conventions and loved Dragon Con in the 90s. You could find just about anything if you explored enough. Now everything is straight-laced and by the books, and it's harder to find that kind of stuff, even on YouTube or the corners of the internet. That con, through my stepdad, is how I discovered the horrors of Sid and Marty Croft and found out they had an amusement park here in Atlanta at one point. Wow. Bad acid trip, the amusement park. Can you imagine?
That sounds horrible. In fact, his story, not the fact that he saw this cool stuff at cons, but Sid and Marty Croft amusement park. Yuck. But that actually reminds me of something that makes me feel much older than I am. And I started going to anime conventions. I like anime. Uh-huh. I started going to anime conventions between 2001 and probably 2007. I went to about 12 of them. And one of the regular recurring features at a certain anime convention was something called Anime Hell. And that had nothing to do with anime. What it was here's a bunch of cool random clips of things. So like that would be like the one time of the year I could see like a weird commercial from the past or a weird outtake or like a weird short film. Now that is just YouTube. Mm-hmm. But I had to like travel to a convention to sit in a room to watch a collection of weird things. It's so I feel like a caveman.
Yeah, you know, I wonder how much that's changed our brains now. The access to the weird things you could normally only watch once a year or, you know, now the pet videos you can only see once a week on America's Funniest Home Videos. You can watch them all the time. Like, that unrestricted access is hurting our brains.
I could put Dog on Fire in a constant loop.
But also, I went to Dragon Con about 20 years ago, and it was definitely less corporate than the cons I've gone to lately. This, I think, still, if you go to the right corner of some cons, probably not San Diego, but you can find people selling bootleg DVDs, but even then, it's just like, look, I'll just download it.
You'll find a torrent or whatever.
And I won't have to, and especially if it's something with, like, naked people in it, I won't have to feel the shame of buying it from a human. I just downloaded it to myself, and the shame is all on my own.
I just read on Facebook that my hometown of Youngstown, Ohio has one of 25 operating porno theaters in the United States.
Wow, man.
What's going on with those people? Do they not know?
I mean, I guess I don't know, it's like $80 a month for internet, and then on top of that, you need a computer or
a phone.
It's probably like $20 to go to a theater.
I don't know what the prices are, but they seem to make it seem like a very pleasant experience.
I guess, yeah, I would hope that you at least get good customer service at those places.
Let's move on to Itchy and Scratchy Land, Henry.
Yeah, so again, everybody corrected me on it. I get it. I was wrong on the island. So JJB Sterling says, oh boy, I've been feverishly waiting for this episode. Fun anecdote. When I was last at Universal Studios Hollywood a few years ago, they were legitimately out of all the Bort merchandise. Not even the irony of the situation made me feel any better about not being able to get a Bort license plate or at least a keychain.
I would kind of appreciate living in the Bort joke. It was a gift from the fates or something like that. Wow, I'm Bart in the Bort world.
Though then again, you won't be back to that place in forever. True. I feel like it would set in. Though if you really want it, you could just go to eBay and
there's probably 50 Etsy shops that just make Bort license plates.
No, they should make eight times the Borts they make of every other thing. A dozen times more.
Actually, a spoiler for did we mention the Bort joke to Bill Oakley, and he was like, we didn't know it would be that famous. Was that the Bort joke?
No, that was in an interview, but he said that elsewhere, not in our interview.
Not in our interview. So Matt Shook says, this is about the Flickies joke. 25,000 miles is roughly the circumference of the Earth. So I think the next Flickies is the one that they just drove past, which they'd have to travel completely around the world to end up back at. Yeah, we didn't get that one. We're sorry.
Some of the math jokes fail us, which is why...
What is this,
like,
Futurama? Oh, God, exactly. We're going to be so screwed if we do Talking Futurama.
We will be. Well, we'll count on the commentaries to explain every math joke to us otherwise, or we're going to need to get another co-host who is a math dork.
Someone much smarter than us.
So Ryan Langley says, a good friend of mine in Brisbane, Australia, was somehow able to get the Bort license plate for his car. How it wasn't already taken, I'll never know. I'm also a game designer in New Zealand and worked on a game recently called Dungeon Inc. When coming up with the name for weird characters in the game, I ended up calling one of them Bort in reference to this episode. It's really hard to get a reference through sometimes. Fun fact, whenever I name something, I have to go through the lawyers to make sure nobody's got these names trademarked. In Bort's case, it was actually fine for in-game use only, but the name has been trademarked for use in advertising and clothing. So as long as I don't make a shirt or use his name in promotion, we're fine.
Wow, Bort is trademarked.
I would think every name said on The Simpsons ever has been trademarked.
Can you put Cromulent on a t-shirt and sell it, or is that legal trouble? So our next one is from Andrew Bouvier. He says, and related to Bort, a few years ago, the NFL team, the Jacksonville Jaguars, drafted a quarterback named Blake Bortles. Bortles or Bortles? I can't see on my screen.
Bortles?
I
think that is an out. Bortles.
Okay, yeah. So Blake Bortles. So rest assured, many a Bort joke has been made at his expense. Good.
Yeah, that is my old home team, the Jacksonville Jaguars, who have never won a Super Bowl. I think haven't even made it into the... They think once made it into the playoffs of the Super Bowl. They're not doing very well. So then we have a comment from Little Devil, the critic episode Little Devil Do Ya, by Sila Chesnovov. Chesnokov, excuse me if I mispronounce. No more wire hangers. Wire hangers make weird shoulder nipples on heavy garments when you hang them up. The rounded padded hangers won't do that, which is why Joan Crawford said she treats the dresses poorly. On a side note, I've always wanted to do a two-person Halloween costume of that scene for Mommy Dearest. Faye Dunaway is so terrifyingly unhinged, and a grown man in pajamas in a curly wig would be hilarious.
I agree. In fact, I agree with Joan Crawford. Whenever I put a heavier thing on a wire hanger, sort of like buckles, and it's not good. So she was right to yell at her daughter.
She was not taking care of those dresses.
So up next, this is the critic, the episode Dial M for Mother. And Robert Flaxman says, the French Jay speaks is actually old French. He says, I won't say this quote because I'll fuck it up, so I'm sorry. Which means, shame be to him who thinks evil of it, or thereabouts. It's the motto of the Chivalric Order of the Garter, founded by King Edward III in 1348. It also appears on the Royal Coat of Arms and as a motto of a number of British and Commonwealth military outfits. As far as I know, it does not appear at the end of Gargantua and Pantagruel or anywhere in it, but it was inscribed at the end of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Okay, so Jay got his reference wrong. It was actually Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which I have read, and it is good.
Oh, really? Yes, well, and also somebody perhaps based on their name is actually French. They also weighed in on the French of this here. That is Charles André Lavallée Jean. Again, forgive me. he says, French literature student here. Gargantua basically ends in Old French with this line, and I'm not going to say it, but it is not what Jay says, which was the previous quote. And basically, that translates to, the end is that after having worked well, they went to eat and shitted a lot.
That makes sense. Apparently, it was a satire, so if it ends on a comedic line, sure, I'll buy it. Yes. So you got the quote wrong, too. Jay is not as smart as he thinks he is.
He isn't talking above his audience here.
It's more like a writer thought he was smarter than he was.
That's true, man. That writer, too full. Gina Reese, again, thinking they were too smart for the room, but not as smart as they thought.
So the Mela experience says, playing catch up here, and maybe it's because it's something that affects me and my family, but the Vitiligo joke has aged about as well as any of the 90s gay jokes. Autoimmune diseases have all sort of side effects, and while people only see these skin blotches and still accuse people of bleaching to look cool, vitiligo also brings liver problems and a generally weakened system. It probably would have killed Michael Jackson by making him more vulnerable to illness. You can read the joke as the writers poking fun at Oprah's prying question, but it also feels like they're mocking what most probably thought at the time was a made-up ailment. Sorry to come here with what feels like an actually, but it's another joke that reminds me of how much things have changed since 1994. And yeah, I agree. I think the joke was like Michael Jackson just saying that to cover up him bleaching his skin. And I think Oprah asked the question because it's what everyone wanted to know. Like, why are you now a white Asian woman?
Yeah, you know? And she had a different perspective than other people asking because she is an African-American herself.
Right.
She could come at it from that angle. But, I mean, I'm guilty of this, too, of not knowing really the effects of vitiligo beyond the skin bleaching thing and that it causes way more problems than that. I know other famous people I know who have it are like pro wrestler Daniel Bryan and comedian in question marks Joe Rogan. They both suffer from that, but they never have really talked about they haven't talked as much about the health issues beyond just having to even out their skin or deal with the skin blotches.
And to be fair, none of that was anyone's business, but with someone as much plastic surgery as Michael Jackson, thinking that he bleached his skin wouldn't be a huge leap in logic after seeing how much he recreated his face, you know. But again, it's none of our business, so yeah.
And I'll read this last one too. This was from the previous talk to the audience, which was from Anthony Zaylor, saying, I was born in 1991, so by the time I was old enough to truly enjoy The Simpsons, there were so many good seasons out. Luckily, in Australia, the channel Fox 8 would play 5 hours of The Simpsons every Saturday and Sunday morning from 7 a.m. to noon, so it wasn't long until I had seen every episode multiple times.
Wow.
Bless cable television. That is quite a deal, I have to say.
Yeah, 5 hours every weekend.
Saturday and Sunday. That is great. I mean, that would have absolutely replaced every Saturday morning show I watched.
Yes, nothing beats The Simpsons.
Or at the very least, I would check, like, I've seen this episode too many times. Let's see what Nickelodeon's doing.
I don't like this Goof Troop episode. be gone. So yeah, those are all the questions. Before we leave, we just want to give you an update as to what's going on with the Patreon. It's doing extremely well, as it has been for a few months now. We are very close to our $8,000 goal, and that is going to be, again, a weekly show with every episode is going to be about a different episode of a different cartoon. I think there's still a little confusion. Some people think, oh yeah, you're going to be that'll be talking Futurama, or that'll be talking King of the Hill, or talking Duckman. That series is going to have a lot of variety, because I love Duckman, but not everyone loves Duckman, and I don't want the thing we unlock to be something only a few people want to
be into. It can't be every episode of Duckman.
Yeah, I mean, Duckman could be a possibility later down the road, but this show we're going to unlock, and I know we're going to unlock it, is going to be a huge like shotgun blast of different cartoons.
Yeah, what I want is more variety, you know, because Simpsons we can focus on, and the critic is great for each episode and great, and it also limited in scope too. It's only 22 episodes plus those terrible shorts, but the time intensiveness to do it, like if we pick another series, then that's what we're doing for years. Yes. If we do Futurama, if we do King of the Hill, we're doing that for years. But if we do a show where we could do a King of the Hill and then maybe go and do a episode of Cowboy Bebop, perhaps, or Steven Universe, or Tiny Toons, or a million,
right,
or Batman the Animated Series, or tons of other shows that are open to us, I would prefer that kind of openness instead.
Yeah, me too. We have a lot to figure out, but I'm thinking like there could be theme months, like a month could be Nicktoons month. We can do like the first four Nicktoons, an episode of each of those. We could do like Fox Animated Sitcom month. I don't know. I mean, there's just so many. I mean, there's just like a million animated shows with a million episodes. So this format is applicable to everything, I think, in that spectrum.
Yeah, and so we definitely want to hit that number. At the very least, you're going to get some... we'll cover your favorite episode, and there are some people who are like our super fanciest level tier people who actually are going to get to pick episodes.
Yeah,
of that,
and some
show
will be actually on the show with us, too.
Yes.
Yeah, with the King Homer level, or that's it?
Yeah, I believe that's the King Homer level, yeah. All hail King Homer.
So yeah, and I wanted to point out, I don't know if this seems crass or whatever, but we are very close to meeting that goal. And if a portion of everybody that's listening and donating just gives one extra dollar a month, we will get there like instantly. So if you want another...
That is how the math works.
Yes, exactly. And if you want just another podcast to listen to that we do on top of the two you get every week, there could be a third one on top of that if you just give a dollar extra. So just consider it. I don't think that's asking a lot, and we're putting a lot of work into this. I love being productive, and I'm going to have my plate so full with this third series, but I can't wait to dig into so many shows I like that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah, me too. I love being an animation historian. I have become like, I've followed so many animators now on Twitter too.
Me too.
And I love getting more into it and focusing on that. And, you know, instead of watching Gamescom this week and all that news that I would have done before, I was like, no, I'm going to watch this old Daffy Duck cartoon. This one,
yes.
Twitter followers.
You're making things people are asking for, not like, here's a preview, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So
somebody read it.
So, yeah, I mean, if every $5 donation went to a $6 donation, it would definitely get us over the $8,000.
For sure, yeah.
But, I mean, we're gradually getting there, but the, you know, obviously the sooner the better, and we could get started on doing it. But not to say, like, hey, we love all your support,
yeah.
Give what you can, and also, you know, tell your friends. If you know friends are like, I just can't afford it, like, even if they just gave $1, you wouldn't get access to all the stuff, but... If we had 1,000 people who gave us $1 a month and that's what they could give, like that would get us there too.
Yeah, that's what I say about Retronauts. Like if every listener just gave us $1 a month, we'd be making like five times what we make on Patreon, to be fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that's not feasible for everybody, but just a tiny tip is better than nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and also as long as we're advertising stuff, the t-shirts, by the way,
right.
The Talking Simpsons t-shirt designed by the wonderful Nina Matsumoto. She made that for us. That is on sale at Shirt Sickle. There was a post of it on the site, but also you can go to, I made up a special URL for it, Bob. If you go to tiny.cc/talking-shirt, that will take you to the shirt. And I just got mine in the mail, and it, seriously, you should check out the fine stitching on dope. It's a really good shirt.
People
like,
are
honestly,
happy with
yes,
them. And if you're in a place where you can't write anything down, if you're driving or jogging or whatever, any Laser Time Simpsons post for the past couple of weeks has a link to it, and it should in the future, I'm guessing. Yeah.
So just, yeah, I mean, go to just talkingsimpsons.com and look on there, and there's a link to it as well. You can see the design. It's $20 and then plus shipping and tax, but that's I think that's a pretty reasonable price.
Yeah, we make
sure
a bit of a profit, and Nina does too, so it's a way to give to all the creators. So yeah, I think we're all through with this month's episode. Are we good, Henry?
Yeah, I think so. Just look forward to, you know, we teased it already, but look forward to another Bill Oakley interviews coming. We've got more interviews in the pipeline. I really enjoy doing those interviews we did in the last month and then the ones we're working on too. I've got a big project I'm working on ever so gradually about Simpsons comic books that I can't wait to share with all of you people.
It's going to be great. Well, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next month with another episode of Talk to the Audience, and we'll see you then.
Infotainment.